The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD, specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray. Please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Good morning, Mrs. Lofting, and how are you today?
Fine.
I've just been talking to your husband on the phone, and he thinks it's high time you were out of here and back in the world again. I think it'll be the best thing for you. Now that you're well, you must pick up your life again, Mrs. Lofting.
Now, you just listen to me. My wife is a very sick woman, and you know it. She's been completely self-destructive. She's locked herself in that goddamn house, and she refuses to listen to reason from me or anyone else. If it goes on much longer, I doubt there's going to be anything that anyone can do.
Just gets taken in by her own imagination.
Maybe Magnus was right. Maybe I am going crazy. I keep feeling hatred.
Don't be frightened.
What about something she'd always wanted to do, to kill a person? She could make us do things for her.
Who is it? Magnus, I know it's you. Get away or I'll call the police.
She'd start breathing hard, but she's still alive.
What do you know about him?
Tortured. He mutilated his little body and they killed him.
As far as I'm concerned, the past is as dead as he is. Do you understand?
It's like stepping out on a window ledge and feeling so alive. Because all the time, part of you wants to jump.
Made herself sick, choked herself. When the child died, she moved away somewhere.
Please don't tell him where I am.
You're some sort of nutter, are you?
No.
Go on, you piss off. Piss off. You come back here and I'll have the law on you. Piss off!
Crazy bitch, then!
Mouthing this about, they'll
lock
you up, you know!
She did it.
Who?
The little girl in the house.
My house. Your house. You must go away. You must leave it. Get out. There's wickedness. Bad things.
Julia? 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 I know you're here. So this is a game of hide and seek. It's over.
Will you stop acting like some kind of a lunatic and come out of this stinking place?
But you're gonna start acting like a grown woman instead of a twisted little child.
You don't know where you are. I am the one who is dead. Evil never dies.
Welcome to The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Rob St. Mary is out this week inciting violence via bad movies in the Middle East. Instead, joining me in the co-host seat this week is Kayla Janisse, author of The House of Psychotic Women, a terrific blend of film criticism and memoir.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. We'll be talking more about Kayla's book a little bit later on in the show, but first we'll be discussing The Haunting of Julia. This 1977 UK film was released originally under the name Full Circle. It was based on a book by Peter Straub, and the film was directed by Richard Loncrane, who we'll be talking to in a bit. The Haunting of Julia is something of a ghost story mixed with a whole lot more going on. It's the story of Julia Lofting, played by Mia Farrow, who we see initially in an idyllic setting with her husband Magnus and daughter Kate. Kate begins to choke on an apple, and Julia's world crumbles after her daughter's subsequent death. This film was made before the Heimlich maneuver, apparently. From there, the film goes on in some very interesting directions, and I must say it really managed to surprise me more than just a few times. All right, Kayla, tell me why, of all the movies you talk about in The House of Psychotic Women, you chose Haunting of Julia to discuss tonight.
Well, Haunting of Julia is a really important film for me, partially because of the autobiographical elements of my book, the character of Julia Lofting and her particular kind of mental breakdown that she goes through. And the issues that she's dealing with in the film in terms of guilt around her daughter's death and the way that she deals with that and the way that it relates to her feelings about her marriage and stuff, a lot of it related to things that I'd seen my mother go through. And my mother is, she looks a lot like Mia Farrow, or she used to when she was younger. And so I always, as a kid, associated Mia Farrow with her. So I talk about a few of Mia Farrow's movies in the book. But Haunting of Julia, to me, is just one of these films that doesn't get written about that much, doesn't get talked about that much. It's until recently was very hard to see, and so that was another reason I wanted to talk about it. And I'm a fan of Richard Longcrane's earlier film, Slade and Flame, as well. It's a really great, creepy film with a great soundtrack, with some, I mean, even in the book, some of the chapter headings are taken from dialogue from this movie. So of all the movies in the book, it is sort of one of the big ones. I mean, they don't really make movies like this anymore. You know, it's really languid and really slow, and there's a lot of scenes of her just, like, lying down on the carpet on the floor, you know, and, like, drawing circles on the carpet with her finger and things like this. And it's just, like, you would never see things like that in a movie nowadays because everybody wants everything to move so fast all the time. And this movie really just took a lot of time with its characters, you know, and that was one of the things I really love about it.
Yeah, I have to say the pacing of it is, it's a little strange at times. I mean, when we finally get to, and I'm not going to do any spoilers on this episode, but when we finally get right towards the end of the film, I really thought there was going to be a whole other act that was going to come along. Mm-hmm. And it ended a little, I won't say it ended abruptly because I enjoyed the ending, but I was just like, oh, okay. It just felt like the things that were happening in that very last part in a, I won't say normal movie, but in most movies that would take at least the last act, if not the second half of the second act and the third act of the film to kind of push through.
Yeah.
But I liked it just because of the way that it was different.
Because it's all building up to that. And I mean, so many other films would take that, you know, like as you say, as a launching point, you know. But instead, it's like kind of building up because it's all a character-driven drama, essentially, building up to these supernatural events. So.
Yeah, there's so many different parts going on in here. I mean, we've got this kind of like mystery of Julia uncovering what had happened in the house before she moved in there, why she moved into this particular house, what's going on with Magnus Kierdelay, who is just, God, he's such a dick in this movie.
Yeah.
Have you read Straub's book is based on? There's some really kind of key differences between the two, or there's at least some stuff that you pick up a little bit more having read the book. I went ahead and I think I watched the movie and then I read the book immediately and then I watched it again because there were things that were happening in the book and I was like, gosh, I really don't remember if that's the way it was in the movie. The biggest one for me was that the Mark character, who's played by Tom Conti, mm-hmm. is actually a stepbrother to Magnus and Lily.
Oh.
And that is not the way it is in the movie, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was thinking, okay, because there's the one scene where Mark meets Lily before they have this seance in Julie's house.
Ah, you must be the remarkable Mrs. Flood.
Oh, no, this is Lily. Mark.
Oh, Lily. Sorry. You must be the remarkable Mrs. Flood.
How do you do?
Come and sit down.
There's a lot of interesting themes and repeated patterns and everything that happen in Haunting of Julia that I really was enjoying. Stuff like the way that stairs play into it. And I know that we're both familiar with how, you know, stairs kind of show up in all of Hitchcock's stuff as far as a descent into madness and everything. But man, there's a lot of stairwells happening in Haunting of Julia.
A lot of stairwells. And then one of the recurring patterns, it's like the most obvious probably is she washes blood off her hands like probably four times in the first half an hour of the movie. She washes blood off her hands several times, which is totally relating to, I mean, it's like a really obvious like signifier of guilt and stuff like that. Lots of great set pieces that happen in stairwells in the movie for sure.
I enjoyed too the use of mirrors. I mean, of course, you know, again, mirrors are a fairly obvious symbol, but the first time that I really noticed it is when she comes around that corner and Mark's holding a mirror, and it's a real great startle in the film.
Yeah, and also it's kind of interesting if you look at her as like she's kind of infantilized a bit more and more in the movie, and the idea of like Alice in the Looking Glass and stuff like this kind of plays out a little bit through the use of mirrors and stuff. There's a lot of back and forth between the characters that she identifies with in the movie, you know, like she identifies with the previous spirit from the house. She identifies with guilt over her daughter, but then she also kind of adopts a childlike persona. So there's a lot of like really interesting identification issues happening between her and the various children in the movie. And the mirrors, I think, sort of play off that.
Yeah, when I think about it, there's a lot of like, you know, there's the two older women, the woman whose son was killed, and then the woman whose daughter was the one that did the killing. And then we get the two men in Julia's life, Mark and Magnus, and kind of weird. I didn't realize until right now that they both start with the letter M. And then we get, you know, the two male companions of the little girl killer who we see grown up. So it's kind of nice that we get all these recurring, you know, these doubles. And you're right, they are kind of, she's kind of bouncing back and forth between who she's going to identify with. And of course, we have the two little girls, the two daughters. And yeah. I like, too, that we initially think that she's being haunted by her own daughter, then ends up being somebody else.
But also very much herself.
You're right. When the scene of her, you know, drawing on the carpet and building the house of cards, and she is kind of becoming that daughter character. And then I will give this spoiler as far as the death of Mark. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty darn sure that she's the one that actually is doing that.
There's definitely hints kind of dropped to that, you know, and again, with the stairwell, talking about stairwells, you see her with her coat on sitting at the bottom of the stairwell of her house in front of the door, like just sitting on the bottom step looking at the door. And then you
right.
see another shot, the same shot, but with her not there anymore. And then Mark is killed by a mysterious force. But I mean, there are hints dropped there that she has put on a coat and she's left the house at that time. So.
Right. And when they show that outside shot of his house, there's that kind of faceless figure that walks by.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even notice that the first time that I watched it. I was like, oh, wow, this is really, it was very subtle and just kind of, it really got under my skin after I
yeah.
watched it. And then I've watched it a few more times since. And each time I pick up on more things as I see it.
Yeah, no, it's a super subtle movie. And one of the cool things about that is that all different, you know, people have different kinds of readings of the things that they see in the movie. You know, like the way that I read the ending of the movie, one of the people who had proofed my book beforehand was like, wow, I totally didn't read it that same way. So different people are getting different things out of it. And that's the good thing about being subtle with a movie, is that then you're not hammering people over the head with one message. You're letting them be able to, like, you're just giving them these little hints and stuff, and they can pick up on whatever the things are that are interesting to them, that are forming the story that they want to see play out, you know, because so much of the movie itself is about projecting, you know, like projecting our own anxieties and our own fears or whatever onto other things and other people. You know, like when Julia first believes that there's a ghost in the house, she's certain that it's her daughter because she wants to believe that, you know. So she's projecting this history or this story like onto the house, which turns out not to be the case. But, you know, but a big part of it is about projection. And I think that by the film's structure and the way that it's so subtle, it allows the audience to kind of do the same thing.
I've never encountered a film where the male protagonists are so in fear, and they should be, of being emasculated as much as they are in this one.
Other than Mark, who's the other male protagonist?
Well, I guess actually it'd be an antagonist, and that would be Magnus.
Magnus, yeah. That's one of the themes, kind of running themes in the book, too, in the movie, too, is emasculation and castration and stuff like this, you know. You know, and obviously the fact that, I mean, and it is obvious in the movie that Magnus is trying to get her money, and that his standard of living or whatever is dependent upon her and stuff. So without her, you know, there's all these different layers of emasculation, you know, or whatever you want to call it, or however you want to, you know, these are pretty facile symbols or whatever, you know. Like, how do you think that Mark is afraid of being emasculated?
I don't know what it is about Mark, but he seems, you know, we talked about Julia being kind of childlike, and he seems very childish. I guess he just, he never seems serious in the movie. He always seems
right.
like he is striving to be more of a little boy in this.
Well, and he lives in this kind of like clubhouse, you know, that's like full of like the old jukebox and all, you know, it's like an antique shop, but you can tell it's kind of like, for him, it's like a playhouse kind of, you know.
I love that song that he plays when he
yeah.
gets killed.
Speedy Gonzalez.
Yeah, I'd never heard that before. That was great. I was familiar with Pepito the Mouse, but never the Speedy Gonzales song.
And that's kind of funny because it really punctuates that scene, you know, because the music is so different from everything else in the movie, you know, like the mood of it is different. It really kind of illustrates like his personality and stuff, you know, which I think is really cool.
I really love the soundtrack for this too. It's a little overbearing at times, like when she's going through her house, but I actually kind of dig that.
I know lots of people who like love it and it's like their favorite soundtrack of any horror film and stuff. But I know that when we played the film at Fantasia, there were some people definitely who wrote kind of blog reviews afterwards going like, oh my God, the score is like too much, you know? But for me, like it's a beautiful score. And Colin Towns told me that actually the demo, like the kind of main theme of the film was the demo of that was played for Mia Farrow. And that was a big part of selling her on the film and getting her to be in it, was that she really liked the music. And it was Colin Towns' first movie score that he did, you know, and a musician playing with, I think, Ian Gillan from Deep Purple, and wanting to branch out and do his own music. And then Peter Federman, who was one of the producers of Haunting of Julia, came into a studio where Colin Towns was playing and basically like just said, hey, can you do music for this movie? And so it was a total like just opportunity. And it was very fortuitous because it came out with an amazing score. So,
yeah. What other things have you found out kind of about the behind the scenes stuff?
Well, just, I noticed when you introduced it, you referred to it as a UK film, but it's actually a UK-Canada co-production. And Paul Korup from Knexploitation could probably talk all about this, but, you know, we had the sort of golden age of Canadian exploitation, the tax shelter era, primarily in the 70s. So there were a lot of production incentives for, you know, foreign countries to come and make movies here in Canada. So Peter Federman had actually started working on the project in the UK, and when looking for funding, he ended up meeting Alfred Pariser, who was a Canadian producer who was doing a lot of tax shelter films and stuff. So the film ended up being kind of a tax shelter project. And the good thing about that was that, you know, it got money for the film. The bad thing about it was that it ended up falling into this kind of rights limbo, you know, like a lot of the tax shelter movies kind of were made by like small companies that were created solely to make that film and to take advantage of tax incentives and stuff. And then as soon as a certain amount of time passed, it all became very gray and muddy as to like where the rights to the film then went, you know, like who owned them. When we were trying to play the film at Fantasia for my book launch there, the Canadian Archives had a copy of the film because they try to get a copy of every Canadian film, basically, and have it in their archives. And so I contacted them, but they would only let the film out if I could prove that I had permission from the rights holder. So then I had to go and try to track down all this information about the rights holder. And both producers of the film were like, you know, we have no idea who owns the rights to this movie. They thought that it had been sold to the bank like decades ago. And it turned out that Sony had bought, trying to think of what it was, but one of the companies that they had bought had television rights for Haunting of Julia, which is why recently there was an HD restoration of Haunting of Julia that played on like the Sony channel or something, because they have television rights, and so they were able to restore it for that purpose. But I don't know if it'll ever come out on DVD or Blu-ray or anything. It came out on VHS in the early 80s, and that was it. So.
Yeah, and right now it's playing over on Netflix via the Instant, at least in the U.S., and I think it's out on, I want to say it's out on DVD in France.
Yeah, that might be possible.
Who knows what? All right, so I want to talk to you more about your book, but first we are going to take a break and play back an interview with director Richard Loncrane after a few words from our sponsors.
Hello, this is Mike from the Badasses Boobs and Bodycounts.com website and podcast. At the BB&BC website, I post thoughts, or reviews, if you will, of lesser-known action, exploitation, and horror films. In the all-new BB&BC podcast, I talk about films of the same genre, but usually with a guest host. We discuss films such as...
And I'm going to let them know that Dolomite is back on the scene. I'm going to let them know that Dolomite is my name, and f***ing up motherfucker. This is my game.
Dolomite, which falls into the badass category. We also look at films like...
I should have taken you for a stone-cold dyke from the start.
Oh! Screw you!
Pervert, in the boobs category. In the body counts category, we cover films like...
What's going on here? What do you think you're doing?
We're having an orgy. What's it to you?
Enjoying the fun?
You all think you're so smart, don't you?
Well, you ain't. You ain't so damn smart after all. You just wait and see.
Somebody's always trying to spoil our fun.
So we have a devil of a good time.
Satan's Cheerleaders. And last but not least, we also look at films such as...
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
We only want to know where Valley Lodge is.
Which way do we go?
Manos, the Hands of Fate, in the Everything Else category. The BB&BC website is located at badassesboobsandbodycounts.com, and the BB&BC podcast can be downloaded from the iTunes Store, the BB&BC website, and is also now available on Stitcher Smart Radio. Just do a search on BB&BC podcast to start listening.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
The Flashbulb Podcast. 3 to 10 minutes of fiction brought to you thrice weekly. From cosmic horrors to fisticuffs, fast cars, and smart mouths, we've got a chill for every spine. Find it all at flashbulb.com or search for it on iTunes.
I was hoping to get some info from you as far as a little bit of the history of the project, how it was received, that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, it's all a very long time ago, as you can imagine, in the mists of time.
Yeah, this was your second feature that you had done?
Second feature, yes. The first one was a film about a rock and roll band called the Slade, who were kind of every Christmas they had a song called Here It Is, Merry Christmas, which I think nets them a few thousand pounds, and I think they live off that still. But they were successful. Actually, they were quite a clever band for the era, the main singer and Noddy Holder. He still has a career. He does radio broadcast now. But very much, I have the habit. Never get behind me in a line. I was back the wrong queue. And I think their career was on the way out when we made the movie. So the film was not a mega hit. Though it's become something of a cult film for the aficionados of that era. But that was my first film, a fairly naive piece of work, I think, in hindsight. It got me started, and then I got asked to do... Of course, you know the film was actually called Full Circle in the UK.
Right.
The Haunting of Julie was the book that it was taken from by Peter Stroud. It was quite a baptism of fire. I think it was probably one of the hardest films I've made. I remember waking up many mornings, you know, that period you have between to wake and sleep and wake when you're not quite sure where you are and you realize, oh shit, I've got to go and direct this movie. It wasn't one of the, I've had some really happy times making movies and some shitty ones, and this was very complicated. We didn't have enough money to make it. I really knew nothing about making movies, you know, very little about making movies. First time producer. We had a Canadian co-production. It was really financed on the Haunting, on the Exorcist, really. That year, I think the Exorcist had come out that same year or year before or something. And so they wanted to make a horror movie. And I think one of the problems with them, I haven't seen the movie for years. I remember it had some good things about it, but overall, I think it wasn't sure what it wanted to be, whether it wanted to be a horror movie or a psychological thriller. And I think that perhaps let it down. And Mia and I were very keen that it was a film that you kind of, you know, that had all sorts of inner meaning. The pretentiousness of the young. And the Canadian financiers wanted just out and out bloodbath. So there was quite a lot of battling about what would happen about it. I think it was very complicated structurally. And I remember I chat occasionally to university kids who are university, you know, students in film. And I always say that one of the stories I tell them is that when I, you know, I saw the film a year after I made it and I didn't understand it. So I probably got wrong. We used to sort of, we'd worked out when we were shooting that, you know, if we moved this vase 3 inches to the left, that would imply that the malevolent child had come in the room and had, you know, you think, well, really, people don't pay that kind of attention, you know, they just don't. It was fraught with anguish. We had a producer on it who I think's dead, but if he isn't, I don't really care, called Alfred Pereza, who the crew affectionately termed Albert Piranha. He was really quite a monster. To give you an idea of one of the events that happened, the opening sequence where Mia, the little girl, chokes to death on the apple, I was kind of keen, and I still am, that you can chill people and you can excite people, and the same applies to sexual scenes. You know, you don't have to show naked bodies to make them attractive and sexual and, you know, and exciting. You can do it very much under sheets, as it were. In fact, probably make them more stimulating and more titillating. And I felt the same about violence. I'm not a big believer in Peckinpah's school of kind of more blood the better. Anyway, Mr. Piranha was not of that school. So we were shooting this scene of the little girl on the floor with a handheld camera, ostensibly choking to death on the apple. And then Mia, who was an ex-nurse and had some experience, but not a lot of tracheotomies and A&E, as it were. So she grabs a knife, and you see the knife approaching the throat, but you never actually see anything. You never certainly don't see the knife making an incision in her windpipe. And Mia is a very sensitive and quite highly strung racehorse when it comes to emotions. Suddenly, we're filming it, and I realize that I'm covered in blood. And Mia is covered in blood, and so is the child, and so is the lens of the camera, more to the point. And what had happened is that Albert Piranha, Mr. Pereza, had decided in his wisdom to throw a Dixie cup full of Technicolor blood over the actors during the scene without telling them in order to generate some excitement. That produced Mia screamed, ran out of the studio, and we couldn't find her for 3 days. She just disappeared. So it was that was sort of one of the incidents that we had. If I tell you how unpleasant this man was, the film he'd done before was called Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane with Jodie Foster. Well, Jodie, who I don't know well now, but I did know pretty well in the distant past, but she used to tell a story of when she made that movie, and she was about 9, I think, 12 or something, not much older. She was obviously quite powerful, but she would come in the morning to her trailer, and she had a map of Toronto or Montreal or wherever they shot the film, and she'd have a ring drawn round from wherever the location was it was shooting on. She would get a pencil and a piece of string, and she'd draw a 1 mile circle or a 3 mile circle, whatever she felt like. And she would then instruct the unit driver to take the producer to that distance from the set. And then when he got there, he had to call back, and then she'd come out of her trailer. I think it's rather one of the more amusing stories about. And I'm not sure it's to his credit or lack of credit that he actually did obey the orders. So we had a pretty tricky producer. And we had, of course, no money and very little experience. But it was a tough film to make. I don't know why it was tough. I guess the script was not bad. I mean, the book, I haven't read the book for 30 years, probably. I think it's probably a better book than a movie. I don't know. It had its problems. You just do your best. But it was a very short schedule. In my 20s, I guess, and pretty naive, and I had dreams that everything had to be absolutely perfect, and I kind of still do, but I guess realism sets in as you get older and you have to balance the reality of economics with the dreams of what you want your film to be like, and I probably pushed that a long way. So there was a lot of battling on the set. I remember the other producer we had. Oh no, it was on another film. I think it was a film that we had another producer. To say the least, it was a traumatic shoot. We had one young Canadian actor, because it was a Canadian co-production. Keir Delay was our Keir Delay Gone Tomorrow was the affectionate term used by the crew about the poor man who didn't really deserve that. He was perfectly nice, but we had another young actor who turned up for a small part, and he was behaving truly badly, and I. Put up with it for a while, and then eventually took him to one side and said, "Why why are you behaving this way? And he actually broke down in tears and said, my agent told me that if I didn't behave badly, I would never get taken seriously. So that was a good lesson in Hollywood and how people thought they had to behave on a film set. It was good fun at times, you know, and really quite hard. We worked, it was the days of 6-day weeks, which I won't do anymore. So we were working 7 days a week, really. We shot it on, I've always thought widescreen was the way to what movies should be, not just because it separates them from television, although, of course, we have 16:9 televisions today. But I felt that Anamorphic produced, I think you can compose and create a much more exciting frame for an audience using, you know, a 2-3-5 format. And that was, I think I'd show all my films, and I think even the first film was that way. But I remember in this film, we had a very, very early Technovision camera, who I'm not sure, I think they're still going now. They make cranes, not cameras. But the camera was so noisy that I've got a rather nice photograph. I'm not sure I can find it, but I had one. Of an armchair, a large Victorian armchair, upside down on top of the camera in order to try and stop the camera noise from interfering with the dialogue. So it was a lot of amateurs doing their best, I think.
Now, this was the second time we'd worked with Conti, or had you worked with him before that?
The first film, Slade in Flame, I think was its title. Tom and I'd worked together on that. That's, I think, where we'd met. And he came. He was kind of the flavor of the month at the time in England. And his career was on the rise. And he's a mannered actor, but he's a very, very solid and was very good and was a good. We don't see much of each other now socially, though we certainly are friends when we see each other. But that was the second film we did, yeah.
Whenever he's on screen, he is the center point. You know, my eyes are always drawn to him because he just seems to be having such an interesting time on the set.
He's an intelligent man. He got on well with me. I think she respected him a lot. And he's demanding. You know, he was demanding about knowing what we were doing and why we were doing it, as indeed he should be. And the trouble is, I'm not sure that any of us quite knew what we were doing. I think the book is full of holes, and I'm sure the movie is full of holes. And I think it would have been a better film if we'd probably if we'd said this is a film about a malevolent ghost. You know, this is a ghost movie. What we tried to do was to make a film where you couldn't decide as an audience whether it was a story of a woman's mental breakdown or whether there really was a malevolent ghost in the house. And I think, I'm not sure audience really want to work that hard, to be honest.
At one point I was thinking maybe Keir DeLeo was gaslighting her.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's amazing how things do get interpreted. It's funny, it's a film that hasn't died, well, it's died, it certainly doesn't run anywhere, but every now and then someone as generous as you is interested in its genre, and I think there's a website dedicated to it somewhere in the world, or a Facebook site, and Peter Hannon, who photographed it, and Brian Morris, who production designed it, I think went a long way to create a credible atmosphere to make the film quite creepy. Most low-budget, as it were, horror movies are made perhaps with less attention to detail. And also Colin Towne's music. Colin Towne, I think that score that Colin that played for me on a piano, I remember the first day he played it, still haunts me. And so still a song that I think gave a poignancy to that last scene with the with a little doll that's clapping, it's clapping the cymbals. I think there's a without the music, all that most movies, you know, Jaws without the soundtrack would probably be less of a successful movie.
I had read that you had a different cut of it that you showed at Cannes.
Ooh, I'm aware of that. I doubt that's true. I don't think we would have had the money to do another cut. I don't think there was. I have no recollection of us doing a. It won the Avoriaz Film Festival. It's quite an interesting story here that the Avoriaz Film Festival, I think, still runs. It's a sci-fi festival, isn't it, in Avoriaz in Switzerland, which is still quite important in Europe. And I remember going along. In fact, that's when I first met Jodie Foster, because Jodie was a young child at the time, and Jodie was there with her mum. I think the reason it won the festival was not because it was the best movie, but it was projected in the correct order, because I remember sitting in the viewing theatre watching Razorhead. They projected the last two reels back to front. And having seen a Razorhead, I'm not sure it would have made much difference, but I was the only one who spotted in the audience, I guess being a filmmaker, that it didn't make sense, the edit. And I remember them saying, well, we didn't really mind. We didn't like it anyway. You can have the prize. So it wasn't the most honestly earned prize, I have to say. It had no advertising budget, really. It was never marketed much, around the world. It just sort of stayed ticking away in the background.
Yeah, what I had read was that there was a love scene between Mia and Tom, and that there was more with Keir Dallea.
I'm not sure there ever was. I think we spent so long lighting every scene that we used virtually every shot we shot, because we would have had a 40-minute movie otherwise. So I don't think there was much time for there was not much time for shooting stuff that we didn't use. I don't have any recollection of a extensive. Mia was quite, prudish is the wrong word, but I don't think she was in the mood for doing love scenes. She was quite erratic emotionally at the time, and I don't think there are any extensive love scenes that were cut out at all. I'm pretty sure that's not the case.
I really hate to say this, but it was a little difficult for me to watch the film just because the print that I have is so muddy.
What a shame. Yeah, it's a beautiful looking film. I mean, the photography and the production design are absolutely impeccable, probably as good as anything I've ever worked on. And sadly, they didn't grade things properly in those days. What a shame. I'm not even sure. I haven't looked at my copies here. I think I've got a DVD, but they usually have been struck off, old prints and all that. I'm really sorry that you had to look at something that was crap. And I suspect those negatives, a lot of that stuff, and we were trying to track. I made a film called Richard III, and a Shakespeare movie, which some years later, which was creatively quite successful, although financially not. And the negative of that has been lost. Well, the soundtrack has been lost. The negative's not, but the soundtrack has been lost. So, we were going to try and re-release that ourselves, because that film never made any money, and it's never been... not even available in the UK as a DVD, I don't think. I think it might be in America. So these laboratories are not great, over a period of time when they change from handwritten databases to computers, an amazing amount of stuff just gets lost in the, lost in the mix of time. So I don't know that the negative or the print of Full Circle really exists. Perhaps one will turn up in some Australian desert village in years to come, and someone will be mad enough to rebuild it, but I'm afraid it's what it is.
It's almost good, though, because there are huge debates online as to what is going on in some of the scenes, because they are a little bit difficult to see. There's this whole thing of what happened to Keir Dallea's character, so it's like, because that's so hard to see that scene when he disappears, so it's like...
I can't remember what happened. He goes to visit he's actually a Canadian actor, in the stairwell. And he falls down the stairwell. Yeah, that was a pretty dangerous stunt. What happened? Why he fell down? I can't remember. Probably didn't make sense, but I do remember we shot that sequence in what is St Pancras Station, which is now has been renovated thanks to an old English architect who's a poet laureate, John Betjeman, who fought some 20 years ago to make sure that St Pancras Station, and if you know it in London, it's the most beautiful mock Gothic station, which is now has been renovated and is a part of the Channel Tunnel train link. But we shot it when it was derelict in this wonderful stairwell. To do the shot of Keir falling over the edge of the banister rail, we put plywood construction about 10 feet down on chains, out of camera vision, and then we put mattresses on the top of it for him to fall over. And I remember, this is sort of how you get wiser as you get older, Keir was a bit nervous about falling over this banister rail and falling probably 8 to 10 feet. And I said, it's fine, Keir, you just, it's a mattress, it's only 8 feet, for God's sake, why are you being such a fusspot? Here, let me show you what to do. So I blithely threw myself over the edge of this rail, and about an hour and a half later, I wake up in my trailer because I've knocked myself completely unconscious, because if you don't know how to fall, even on to mattresses, you can, you knock the wind out of yourself. So we never got Keir to do it, but we did. The actual stunt was done by a man called Alf Joint, who I think has passed away now. He held the world's high diving record for many, many years. It was a fairground high diver, the ones who dive into kind of 18 inches of water with straw underneath, in traveling shows. he did the Ridley Scott in his youth, did a Cadbury's commercial, Cadbury's Milk Tray, which is a chocolate over here, dive. And Alf did the highest dive on record in a Greek island and actually broke his back on the second dive. But this was after my stunt, but when you do a fall in a stairwell, it's one of the most dangerous things that a stuntman, one of the most dangerous things they can do, because I wanted him to fall directly away from camera, so we built a scaffold rig in the middle of the stairwell, and then the camera was mounted in the middle of that scaffold rig, pointing straight down, and the base of the stairwell was a marble tiled floor, so we put cardboard boxes to whatever height they required, and then we stretched the canvas painting of that stair of those tiles over the cardboard boxes, so you couldn't tell. And then at the right moment, Alf would was meant to release his hands and his feet at the same time and fall directly away down on the high speed camera towards the and hit the boxes. But the danger is in a stairwell, and I'm probably talking about 10, 15 feet diameter, not much more, that you've only got to release one hand or one foot fractionally later, and you get a pendulum effect. Alf did do that, and he landed. I was down at the bottom watching it, and I picked him up, and his head was about probably an inch and a half from the concrete edge of the step. So he was very lucky to be alive, and I think even he was quite nervous. He said it was the most dangerous stunt he's ever done. Not that he was a man who ever made a fuss, but he didn't say anything afterwards. But it's the kind of stunt that stuntmen just don't do anymore. They just refuse to do it because they know that there's no margin of error. But it produced quite a good image.
I wanted to know what it was like working with Dave Humphries.
Dave Humphries, the writer. Dave was a very good friend. He sadly died of a brain hemorrhage, brain tumor, actually, many years ago now. The original script was going to be written by someone else, and then Dave took it over. David was one of those writers. He had a wonderful sense of humor. In fact, to give you an idea of what the sense of humor he did have, when he discovered that he had a brain tumor, I went to visit him in hospital, he said to me, "I hope I haven't lost my sense of humor," which is not a bad gag for a man who's dying.
Yeah.
David was a wonderful writer, and I miss him dearly. Yeah, it was great. He just, you know, he was a working writer. He didn't, you know, he's one of those writers who got up and started writing, and when lunchtime came, he had lunch, and then he got back to writing again. You know, he wasn't a man who sat on desert islands and looked at the sea and contemplated his navel. He was a professional writer. He'd worked in magazines for many years and had been a magazine writer. He wrote a very successful in his latter years a TV series about the London Fire Brigade, which I think made him a lot of money, well, a decent amount of money to live off in his later years. But I don't remember the day-to-day details, but I remember that he was one of the few people who could handle Mia very well. We had Andrew Birkin working on it, and I think Andrew and Mia did some writing on it as well. Andrew still writes, and I think he and Mia hit it off pretty well. So I had some support. It was hard because I was so inexperienced. I was in my 20s, I think, when I made the film, maybe late 20s. She was the biggest star I'd ever worked with, and she was obviously at the zenith of her career. Not that she was particularly difficult. She just was quite erratic, so it was quite complicated sometimes to, my naivety assumed that with an actor, you said, "I'd like you to stand by the door," and when they say the line, "open the door," well, that isn't always the case with actors. They have to understand why they're opening the door and at what moment. So I think both Dave Humphries and Andrew were very good allies in persuading Mia why we were doing something and for what reason. I had a lot of help. I'm a great believer I think I remember I had a T-shirt printed on the first day of shooting, which said, "Don't rush me, I'm thinking." I don't wear it anymore, but I still remember the sentiment. I think that when you're shooting as a director, it doesn't really matter that you say to the crew, "I have absolutely no idea what the next setup is. Go and have a cup of tea and I'll tell you." What matters is if you try and bullshit them into pretending you know what you're doing for 10 minutes and actually you don't. So providing you're honest with, it applies in life perhaps, but certainly on film sets, that if you can just, if people know that you don't know what you're doing, that's fine. They just want you to know you don't know what you're doing. If that isn't a double negative, I'm sure it is.
That was director Richard Loncrane. We also had the pleasure of talking to author Peter Straub about his book on which the film was based. Let's start with the book. I mean, this was this the third one that you had written, second one that was published?
It was the third novel I wrote and the second that was published, but it was the first supernatural novel I wrote. I had run into trouble with my second novel, which I couldn't place anywhere in England or the U.S. I was in England at the time. And the reason I couldn't was that my first novel, which wasn't very good at all, hadn't at all sold well. And so I didn't look like a very good bet to these publishers. And I tried revising it for a very long time, became more and more depressed. And finally, it seemed to me that what I should do was try to write something that would have a good shot at being published, something that would appeal to publishers. And I could have chosen to write a crime novel, and I'd always liked crime novels. But what I chose was a sort of a horror idea, because at the time there were two or three books, and only those two or three, that were horror novels and doing extremely well both at bookstores and as films. There were The Exorcist, Rosemary's Baby, and the other, though I don't think the other was filmed then, but it was an immense bestseller for Tom Triumph. I'd read Rosemary's Baby, and I'd seen the movie, and I'd loved it, and I hadn't read The Exorcist, but I'd certainly seen the movie, and I thought it was just amazing. So I thought that it might be possible for me to do something along those lines. And my other goal was was to have the secretaries at the publishing house know my name, so that when I called up and I said, "Hi, this is Peter Straub. I'd like to speak to Editor X," they wouldn't say, "Who?" They'd say, "Oh, I'll push it right through." So I spent a lot of time trying to invent an idea that might actually work and might be sort of frightening. I bought a secretarial notebook, a shorthand notebook. I went on long walks around London looking for ideas. I went on Hampstead Heath, and then I went further south in London. And I had a couple of ideas, but they were really terrible ideas. And I told a couple of them to my friend Tom Tessier, who was engaged in the same sort of thing at the time, and still is. And when he laughed, I knew they were really lousy ideas. Anyhow, finally, after I wandered around Holland Park, which is a long way from where I lived, I had an idea of a little girl doing something with a knife in Holland Park, surrounded by other children. And that struck me as being really spooky and actually, you know, scary. So I thought I was on to something. And after that, I spent time with my notebook, and I worked out what seemed to be a doable novel. I wanted it not to be straightforwardly a supernatural novel. I wanted there to be ambiguities within it, because I was and am a huge Henry James fan. And one of the points of the Turn of the Screw, and one of the reasons the Turn of the Screw is so powerful, is that it is ambiguous at its heart. So I thought maybe I could try pitch my ball into that particular court. I just set to work. When I reached the time when I could write the first sentence and was writing it, I felt all of a sudden I felt good. I looked at the sentence and I saw that I was writing just about as well as I ever had. So immediately I felt confident about it. And after that, I just plugged along, doing a little bit every day, 7 day a week, or at least 6 day a week basis. And when I came to the end, it seemed to me that I had something pretty decent. I thought it would serve the purpose that it had to serve, to be effective for me. That is, it did seem to me that it was acceptable by publishers, and the publishers might have some, or might display some enthusiasm for it. So I gave it to my agent then, who was new to me. She had a minor role at the agency that I started off at, which is a big, old-fashioned, very high-quality English agency. But she'd been trying to get me to be published in magazines. I'd written a few stories under a pseudonym for women's magazines, and she managed to place two of them. I wasn't particularly gifted at that end of the business. This woman, agent, sent my manuscript to two houses, and no, she sent it to one, and they were immediately enthusiastic about it, and they made a decent offer, and then she sent it to another one, Jonathan Cape, which was at the time far and away actually the best publisher in England. They were the Knopf of the UK. And boss there flipped. He thought it was really good. And then I somehow acquired an American agent. I can't remember who that agent was. The book was sent to the publishing house, which no longer quite exists. It's called Coward McCann, later Coward McCann and Hagen, who had published my first not very good novel, Marriages. And an editor there read it and also thought it was really usable. And so she made a handsome offer, too. And so my life had been saved, and I was set on my path. I wasn't quite aware of it, but I had found something that I knew how to do. And I'd found the kind of fiction in which my talents were best expressed. So it was a happy time. And I believe that same agent, English agent, found a young guy, very agreeable man named Peter Fetterman, who became the producer of Full Circle. He made an offer for the film rights. And, it was for very little money. But it was clear that he had very little money to spend on the film projects, but it was what he was really interested in doing. And he and I were approximately the same age, I'd say. That is, in our early 30s. He might have been a little older, but not much. And he was a very agreeable guy. So once he had the film rights, he found a guy to write a script. And it's my impression that this man, whose name I don't remember, was a liking man for films. I met him only once. He came to my house, my apartment, I guess, in London for a meeting. I wasn't tremendously impressed by him. He looked like a man who saw very little daylight. And there was even a faintly greenish cast to his skin, as I remember. He looked like a creature of the night who needed a little more sleep. He wrote the script, and Peter Fetterman, after gargantuan, Herculean efforts, managed to attract enough money to begin filming. I think a big part of that was getting Mia Farrow to agree to appear in it. Before I knew it, they had a schedule, and they began the shoot. I went one day down to the area of Knightsbridge or Kensington where they were filming a little scene. It had an English character actor in it who was very well known, but whose name I'd long forgotten, and Keir DeLay. And I watched the little scene unfold, three times and four times and five times, and finally the director was satisfied. Peter Fetterman had introduced me to everybody. He said, "Would you care to meet Mia?" And I said, "Oh, yes, of course." So he took me to this trailer, and way at the back of the trailer, seated was this little tiny woman, Mia Farrow, who looked at me with huge, limpid eyes and whispered a few kindnesses. I first saw it at a screening somewhere, and my wife's parents were in London at the time, so they came along. Of course, they were very excited. They didn't much like it when this old woman who'd been in Brief Encounter, and she was the original mother of the bad little girl, who Olivia Rudge. Anyhow, my mother-in-law was very fond of this actress, and she was a little taken aback when down there towards about the three-fourths way through the movie, that particular old lady said something really, really obscene. My mother-in-law was rather jolted. At the time, I wanted very much to like the film, so I sort of did. I liked Mia Farrow. I thought she was terrific, and I thought some of the things that Richard Longcrane, the director, did with Mia Farrow were simply spectacular. I mean, just like radiant little shots. I did notice the Green Man, our screenwriter, decided to economize by not making clear the connections between the principal characters. You never really know that those two men, Keir DeLay and the other one, who's that?
Tom Conti.
Tom Conti, absolutely, that's right. He was a very famous English actor at that time. The screenplay does not make it clear that they are brothers. So you can't figure out what the relationship is and why they act that way toward one another. And big chunks of exposition were left out. And so the whole thing looked slightly surreal to me. It did have a very stirring, kind of a stunning ending, I thought, which I still like. But I was really of two minds about the movie. I went to see it once more in London, and I saw it once more when we had videotape. I saw it on videotape here in this country. Over time, I began to dislike it more than I liked it, but I thought the kind of surreal nature that was imposed by not having the certain exposition and not making clear the relationships of the two male characters. I thought that lent a kind of an interesting, surreal quality to the film. It wasn't intended, but I thought it was there, and I thought that was nice. It seems to me that the film has gained in respectability and it's picked up a lot of approval, and people are seeing it in a new way. And I couldn't be happier. I'm very pleased about it, and I should watch it again myself.
What was a nice boy from Wisconsin doing over in London at this time?
After I got an MA at Columbia, I ran out of money, and rather than get another student loan, I went back to Milwaukee, and I got a job at my old boys' school teaching English. And I was very good at that, it turned out. I wouldn't have known I was, but I was just amazing. And in my first year, the students there carried me through the halls on their hands. So it was nice. By the third year, it was not being so nice anymore. And I when I looked into the future, it looked a little grim, because I was getting older and the students were getting younger, and my magical connection with them was beginning to fade. So I wanted a PhD. I also wanted to write, but I thought I still carried around these parental strictures in my head that said you'd be a fool if you tried to write for money. You better get a job or you'll starve. So I thought the only kind of job I really wanted was that of an English professor. And I also wanted to go somewhere interesting. So I applied to University College Dublin for the PhD program in English there, and I was accepted. So in 1969, my wife and I moved to Dublin, where we quickly fell into a real artsy world of poets and painters and sculptures, and it was just immense fun. And I learned a tremendous amount, and I began to write. I'd been writing poetry very seriously, and I wrote a lot of that, and I got it published. And one summer, instead of working on my thesis, which was becoming odder and odder, I wrote a novel, that first novel. I just went to the National Library in Dublin, and I wrote it by hand in a big bound notebook. And later on, I revised it and typed it up. And when the oddness of my PhD thesis became known to my supervisor, and he suggested that I start all over again, I mailed the novel to an English publisher, a good one named Andre Deutsch, and they accepted it. So at that point, my wife and I moved to London, and I got an agent there, and I just settled down to write for a living. And we went through ups and downs, and finally, with the novel that was first called Julia's House, that couldn't be called that because there was a children's novel on the Jonathan Cape list that had the same title, and they get the royalties mixed up. So we changed the novel to Julia. After that, my life began to move recognizably toward the direction it's had ever since.
So it's kind of ironic that you're inspired a little bit by Rosemary's Baby, and there you have Mia Farrow playing Julia.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. She was uncertain about doing it because it did seem to her perhaps a little too close to Rosemary's Baby. But she changed her mind. It's obvious to me that her name there on the cast list was the primary reason Peter was able to raise enough money to have it filmed.
Didn't they make a big deal with Rosemary's Baby about the way that she had her hair cut back then?
It was a big deal. That's right. She was one of the first women, maybe the first public woman in America, to get that sort of pixie, Peter Pan, little boy look. Yeah. Of course, it looked radiantly cute on her.
Because I found it kind of funny that she was pretty much wearing the same hairstyle in Julia, too, so that the two films kind of go together very well in many ways.
Yeah, that's right. But, that's the hairstyle she wore in civilian life. Is the hairstyle she had when she married Frank Sinatra.
It's funny that the park was your inspiration because that park is so central to your book. I love that Lily is on one side of the park and Julia is on the other side, and they always have to pass through that in order to get from one house to the other. It's kind of this, like, nexus for the book.
Yeah, you're right. When I went there, probably for the first time, it just looked right to me. And so I walked around. I made notes on the places. I saw the building where Lily lives, and I saw where I wanted to place her apartment. Julia's house is a little less specific, but there are houses just like that immediately outside the park. It's a very handsome neighborhood, Holland Park, and it's a great little park.
I really appreciated, too, that the book was very much an investigation. The way that Julia is going about stuff is kind of this, she's not a passive character in that she's just being haunted, that she's actually actively looking for what's going on and is just so driven all the time.
Yeah, she wants to find out what's happening. She wants to find out, solve the mystery of that girl. Because, of course, in her life, there is one resounding mystery that's based on a huge denial. The biggest fact in her life is hidden from her by herself. I think when there are hidden facts, people tend to look for information. She has all kinds of reasons for wanting to work out what happened in the past to bring about the circumstances of the present. And it looks darker and darker as she goes along. But you're right; she does persist. She tracks down all of those people with rather dire consequences.
You had mentioned the big change about kind of removing Mark from the family in the movie,
yeah.
But also the change that making Magnus a lot younger and making it so that it was his daughter kind of haunting Julia, his other daughter, I should say.
Yeah.
That was an interesting choice as well, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't explain that. Magnus should have been older and much bigger and sort of more formidable character. Keir DeLay was really good, I thought, and he's certainly a dandy actor, but perhaps he didn't have quite the menace that Magnus Lofting should have had. But anybody named Magnus Lofting has got to be pretty serious,
Yeah, Magnus kind of struck me as almost like a replacement father for her.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I think that's right.
How did your experience with this one kind of compare to being adapted again with Ghost Story?
My relationship with the producer and everybody else, to the extent that I met them, with Full Circle or Haunting of Julia, was really warm and nice. It was, you know, I felt kind of welcomed to the degree that was appropriate for me to have any part in it at all. And I was very friendly with Peter Fetterman and remained friendly with him since then. Things couldn't have been more different with Ghost Story, which was, of course, done with Universal, which meant that the contract was a lot more forbidding, though I was guaranteed periodic looks at the script, and I was assured that I'd be invited to the set. After things have been going along a long time, I remembered the bit about the script, and I asked my agent to check into it. It was a different agent now. And he said, "Oh, Peter, they're long past that. They're already shooting." "Oh," I said. "Any chance of my going to see it and to see them shoot some scenes?" And he said, "No, they don't want the author on the set." There we go. You know, I never saw the script, and I didn't see any of the shooting. Later, it seemed to me that perhaps they didn't want me to do that because they would sense that I might object to some of their decisions. And some of their decisions baffled me for decades. I couldn't understand why they didn't film some of the most interesting parts of the book. And I didn't understand why they took out my engine and replaced it with a smaller, tinier, you know, clunkier, more cliche kind of engine. As it turned out, I knew the screenwriter, Lawrence Cohen, right, thank you very much, because he'd been affiliated with a lot of Stephen King things that had gone very well. And he was a good guy. And I thought that he had a peculiar lapse of some kind. A long time after that, Lawrence Cohen began to talk to me about doing the screenplay for another of my books. And I said, "Of course, let's do it." And he said, "Well, let's have lunch." So we had lunch. He was with his partner. And almost the first words out of his mouth were, "I hope you don't blame me for what happened to Ghost Story." I wasn't sure who to blame, if blame was the word. And he told me that he had written scenes that replicated the parts I called kind of interesting, or referred to as some of the most interesting parts of the book, which are kind of surreal, that he'd written those scenes, and they had been filmed, but the studio officials, or studio executives, had decided to display their own creativity, and they'd gone through the film and taken out all those scenes. It was curious because there'd been a big feature about the making of the film in the nice little magazine, Cine Fantastique. There were stills in that article of certain of the scenes that I'm talking about. And so I was baffled that they weren't in the movie. Well, it turned out, you know, everybody's creative and you just can't keep them down. It took me a long time to admit to myself that I didn't think that movie was really any good at all. Because talk about surreal, these unexplained, threatening characters come in with no backstory, no background, and no function. Gregory and Fanny Bate appear drooling over pearls on a staircase, and they don't seem to have any function. In the book, they're extremely important, and they turn up again and again. So, I mean, that one was kind of a lost opportunity. If it had been half the film that it should have been, people would still be seeing it and turn up on TV a little more often, and it was sold many more copies of the book. So it was, because it was a big studio film, it did sell a huge amount of paperbacks, which I was grateful for.
It never hurts, right?
That's right.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. As I mentioned earlier, our guest co-host this week, Kayla Janisse, picked the film that we're talking about, and it's featured in her book, House of Psychotic Women. Now, I have to tell you that I'm really glad we didn't do House of Psychotic Women, the movie itself, this week, because it kind of took me a few years to get the theme song for it out of my head. So for the folks listening at home, can you talk a little bit about how you blended the film reviews and memoir as your book? I mean, where'd you get this idea, and how long did it take to write? I mean, this is, to me, I've never seen anything quite like this kind of amalgamation that you put together, and I love it.
It was a long process. I basically started the book 10 years ago. Like, my first kind of notes for the book are 10 years old. And, of course, I rewrote it and rewrote it a million times between then and now. But it wasn't always supposed to be a memoir. It wasn't supposed to always have autobiographical elements or anything like that in it. It was originally going to be a book of essays, like maybe 10 essays about different psychotic women movies that I liked, you know, which was just kind of expanding upon previous writings I had done at that point in my fanzine. You know, as more time passed, I would always want to include more movies. And so then this list of things I wanted to write about just grew and grew and grew. And then it just got really, like, unwieldy. And I just kind of, like, kept losing focus and not knowing what I wanted to do with it. You know, and then trying to write something that was just, like, a heavy theory book or something like that, I just didn't really have the chops to do it. You know, like, I mean, there was no way I was going to be able to write some kind of groundbreaking final girl type theory or something. You know, I just didn't have the academic background to do it. And people would be able to tell, I think, if they read it, you know. I thought at first about maybe putting some personal anecdotes in it, like kind of as little sidebars or something. But then some friends of mine who I was talking to about it, Caitlin Battenstall, who wrote They Came From Within, which is a great book about Canadian horror films, and Matthew Rankin, who's a filmmaker that I know, both of them were really kind of pushing me to go with this idea of it being autobiographical in a sense, because they were like, you know, whenever you talk about these films, when you get excited about them and when you try to explain to people, like, what you like about them, it's always personal. You know, you're not analyzing the movies necessarily from this, like, really objective standpoint. You're always looking at these movies as in terms of how you relate to them personally, you know, and what they remind you of and what things they trigger for you and stuff, you know. And so it was kind of after having these sort of conversations that I realized that maybe I should go with that kind of an angle. But it was tough because, you know, obviously it's like, well, who wants to read a memoir by me? I'm not famous or anything, you know? So it's like, who wants to read a book about my crappy life? You know, like, it was just, it seemed like it would be easier in some ways to write a book like that, that the words would maybe flow out of me better. But at the same time, it seemed really kind of narcissistic and presumptuous to think that I could, like, put this book out there and that people were going to be even remotely interested in reading stories about my life, you know? And so, you know, I started working on it, but I was always, like, really afraid of the end result, you know, of that it would come out and that people would just be like, well, what is this? You know, like, I just want to read about movies. Why do I have to read about this stupid person's life or whatever, you know? And I've been lucky in that the few people who've read it so far think that the way that it goes in and out between movie analyses and the personal stories from my life, I tried to keep it kind of flowing and as balanced as possible so that it's almost kind of like a narrative in itself. And that was also a challenge because I'm not a narrative writer at all. You know, like I tend to write articles in magazines. I write essays for books and magazines and stuff. And you know, so to be able to write something that was this long and draw it out and make it into an actual narrative that had flow and had a beginning, middle, and end, you know, for that extended period of time, was also a huge challenge to me, you know, to connect everything. Because even though it was connected in my head, you know, all these films were connected in some ways in my head to my own experiences, it was definitely a challenge to be able to get out of my own head enough to put it on a page and be like, is this going to make sense to anyone? You know, it was tough. And then also it just became emotionally really tough to write it also, because it's, you know, if you're talking about, you're writing about movies about psychotic women and then saying that the book's autobiographical, obviously that means that you are going to get into some heavy subject matter, you know, personally. And so that was also hard. And I found it really, emotionally difficult and draining and stuff to write it sort of as it went on.
Well, I think you hit, you know, the word that kept coming to my mind as I was reading it was balance, and just the great flow that you did have between the autobiographical and the films, and just the way that you kind of effortlessly would go from one into the other. And I really appreciated that when you got into the films, it just wasn't this passing thing, that you really kind of dove deep into these. And you said that you couldn't handle a full theory book, but I love that you aren't just giving us the typical plot point, here's how it relates to me. You are looking at the theory and really kind of diving into these a lot more than a typical, you know, movie review would be. It's more of a great essay. And just the way that you are making that transition between the two, I just was astounded. And the thing that I kept thinking of as I was reading this was you were sparking so many ideas in my head as far as you would be talking about a film, and I would start to think, oh yeah, there's another film that's kind of like this. I wonder if she's going to talk about this. And then, you know, just it, usually within like another paragraph, you would mention that film, and I would be like, oh, okay, good. Or I would say, you know, I wonder if she's seen this movie, and then sure enough, within, you know, a couple pages, you would talk about that. So it was really nice, you know, it felt like a nice conversation. Like the best kind of conversations that I ever have, which are the ones that kind of blend personal experiences with movies and with, you know, thoughts on films and looking deeper into stuff than just that kind of surfacey level. So I was really taken aback by it. And it also made my my Netflix queue swell. I have to say, there were a lot of films that you talk about that I'd heard about, maybe some I had never heard about before, and I really, you know, I'm tracking them down now. So I've tracked down Footprints, the Giallo, Giallo from Outer Space almost. And then, you know, I had heard of Secret Ceremony, I'd never seen it, so that one's on my queue now.
Oh,
and I can't
Secret
wait
Ceremony
to see
is
it.
Amazing. Yeah, it's another Mia Farrow great one.
Yeah, it sounds terrific. And I wanted to see that before we even talked about Haunting of Julia, but it just didn't work out timing-wise. But yeah, it sounded like it would be a great triple feature with like that and Rosemary's Baby and Haunting of Julia all together. How's the reaction been so far? Have enough copies sold that you can kind of get that reaction? Or are you still kind of waiting for it to, you know, the floodgates to open a little bit more?
Well, we've sold quite a few, but it's kind of weird because I haven't heard anything. I've heard very little from people, you know, which is kind of weird, you know, like the, like I know that like hundreds of the books have sold so far, and then plus, you know, press copies have come out and everything, but there aren't really any reviews or anything online yet. People I know personally have said good things to me about it. But other than that, it's like I haven't heard anything, so it's kind of scary. Like, I don't know if they like it or not, but I also don't know if they're just like, you know, one of my fears, obviously, in making the book so personal, because it does get extremely personal, you know, and part of my fears of that was that, you know, people were going to be afraid to talk to me or something, you know, and so I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But yeah, so I haven't really heard the real reactions or anything yet.
Would you say that writing the book was kind of therapeutic, or was it more difficult than actually, you know, did you breathe a sigh of relief after it was done, or are you still tense about it?
No, I'm still definitely tense about it. I mean, it was therapeutic in a sense, like in the way that it can be, like, I mean, I'm a talker. I do tend to talk out my problems, you know, like there's people who don't like to talk about their problems, and I will always talk about my problems because, I mean, from when I was a kid, I was in group homes and stuff, and they make you talk about your problems whether you want to or not, so I'm just used to it. So, you know, it was therapeutic in a sense to kind of put things out on paper and then to be able to see the connections happening sometimes before my eyes, you know, like a lot of the connections I made between the movies and my life were not actually there originally. You know, there were like a few key things, but then when I started writing and I would just be like, oh man, this totally is like this and this is like this and these things totally go together and that's so strange. Like, and getting like a better picture of like what it is I get out of these movies, you know, like I would get a better picture of that when I would see them all like kind of laid out in a row, you know? So that was therapeutic in a sense, you know. But it wasn't, yeah, at the end, there definitely wasn't like a sigh of relief. I definitely didn't feel as though I had closure or something, which is why there's that facetious James Ellroy quote at the beginning of the book and stuff. You know, but yeah, so I definitely didn't feel like, oh, well, I'm glad that's over and all those problems are solved now.
know? Tell me a little bit more about your premiere with Fantasia in Montreal.
Well, we had the Fantasia Festival did kind of a sidebar where they had four films connected to the book. And The Haunting of Julia was kind of the official launch, like the world premiere of the book, a rare screening of Haunting of Julia, which I introduced, and then we had all the books for sale. And then the Cinémathèque Québécoise has a crazy film archive, and so I was allowed to pick some movies from their archive to play as part of the series also. So I played Dr. Jekyll and His Women, the Valerian Borovchek movie. I played Christiana F., oh, and Possession, obviously, yeah, Possession.
Oh, wow.
Possession is a key movie in the book. And Christian F. doesn't really fit the theme as much, but it's like when you get into kind of the middle of the narrative of the story, it had more to do with my life than with Christian F. being characterized as a psychotic woman, you know, but it was more just that I couldn't pass up the opportunity to play a subtitled 35mm print of Christian F. because it's such an amazing film, you know. And then Austin's Fantastic Fest is doing a sidebar with completely different movies. And I got to pick those movies too. And I'm really excited about that because they essentially let me pick almost anything, you know. Like, whereas, like, in Fantasia, I was kind of limited to whatever the Cinémathèque had in their archive, which was substantial enough. But with Austin, they basically were like, okay, anything. So of all the movies in the book, like of, you know, 200 or so movies that I talk about in the book, they were like, if we can get prints, then, you know, we can play them. And so the ones that we're doing in Austin are Secret Ceremony, The Mapu Cage, which I'm so excited about because I don't think anyone ever plays this movie, and The Entity. The Entity is a big movie in the book. It's kind of the first movie that I think that I talk about in the book.
Awesome. Wow, that sounds great. When is the Fantastic Fest again?
It actually starts next Thursday or Friday, I think. Thursday. And then the films related to my book are playing on from the 25th to the 27th of this month.
So you're doing Austin, you've done Montreal, you did an event in Toronto.
Yes.
Where else have you been and where else are you going?
Well, those are the only ones I've done so far. And beyond that, I've got, I'm doing something at the 92Y Tribeca in New York at the end of November.
Those guys are great.
Yeah. It looks like I'm going to be doing something at the Brattle in Boston or in Cambridge or whatever on December 1st or 2nd. Winnipeg, possibly the beginning of November. Edmonton in the middle of October. So there's like at least five other things set up right now.
If folks want to keep up, you know, if they want to learn more about, you know, what these screenings are going to be, where they can go, where they can buy books, all that kind of stuff, do you have a site set up or is there a good place where they can get kind of the central location for information?
In addition to the Fab Press site, the publisher, his website is fabpress.com, FABPRESS.com. But I also have a personal website, bigsmash.com, which is big-smash.com. And so all of my sort of book launch things and whatever various projects I'm involved with are all on that website.
Cool. And I'll be sure to link to both of those on our website, which is, of course, projection-booth.com. All right, we're going to take another break and play some previews for our upcoming shows.
We're coming to you live from Pittsfield Township, where events of a gruesome mass murder are just now unfolding.
What we can tell you is that 10 bodies have been found dead, and that number is expected to climb before this is over.
Your neighbor is not content with playing violent video games or watching terror porn.
He wants to smell it. He wants to taste it.
Today's sicko wants the real thing.
I know of a little party going on this evening if you guys are interested.
We would love to go.
It's invite only.
This is Night of the Living Dead.
This is Alfredo Garcia. He's about to become a very important man.
We are looking for an old buddy of ours, a compadre named Alfredo Garcia.
A private army is scouring three countries to find Alfredo Garcia.
Well, don't worry, if he's alive, I'll find him. Alive isn't our problem.
Someone has offered $1 million for his head.
If I ever get my hands on him, I'm going to kill him.
All ever required from you is physical proof that Garcia is dead.
And we're prepared to settle for his head.
Bring me the head of Alfredo Garcia. This man will become an animal.
Alfredo!
Alfredo's our saint. He's the saint of our money.
I want to take it to him.
I love you.
This woman's dreams of love will be destroyed.
I've been here before. You don't know the way.
Innocent people will suffer.
With Alfredo's help, we can do anything, honey.
Holy ground will be desecrated.
You don't want me to be part of that, do you?
You are a part of it.
25 people will die.
Just being together is enough.
No, it's not, baby.
All because of Alfredo Garcia. And only one man really knows why.
Kill him.
Sam Peckinpah, director of the greatest adventure films of our time, has made possibly his most powerful and startling motion picture.
Those were some previews for our upcoming shows. In just 2 days, we'll be dropping the final bonus episode for what has proven to be an insane month of September. We'll be talking to fellow Michigander Douglas Schultz about his film Mimesis or Mimesis. Hopefully, we'll finally get the answer on how you pronounce it. And we'll also be interviewing one of the film's stars, Mr. Sid Haig. And we'll be back at our regularly scheduled time next week with an episode on Sam Peckinpah's Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. So get the vodka ready. I want to thank this week's special co-host, Kayla Janisse. Thanks again for joining me here in the projection booth.
No problem. Thank you.
Be sure to pick up a copy of her book, The House of Psychotic Women, today. You won't be sorry.
It was a moonlit night in old Mexico. I walked alone between some old adobe haciendas. Suddenly, I heard the plaintive cry of a young Mexican girl.
You better come home, Speedy Gonzales, away from Tannery Row. Stop all of your drinking with that floozy named Flo. Come on home to your adobe and slap some mud on the wall. The roof is leaking like a strainer. There's loads of roaches in the hall. Speedy Gonzales, why don't you come home? Speedy Gonzales, how come you leave me all alone?
Hey, Rosita, I have to go shopping downtown for my mother. She needs some tortillas and chili pepper.
Your dog is gonna have a puppy, and we're running out of coal. No enchiladas in the icebox, and the television's broke. I saw some lipstick on your sweatshirt, I smell some perfume in your ear. Well, if you're gonna keep on messing, don't bring your business back here. Speedy Gonzales, why don't you come home? Speedy Gonzales, how come you leave me all alone?
Hey, Rosita, come quick. Down at the cantina, they're giving green stamps with tequila.